from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour has been made all month long here on WXXI News, thanks to the efforts of my colleague Michelle Faust. Today we wrap up our series of reports called Heroin at Home. We've been looking at heroin and opioid addiction, especially in Western New York. Now, all month, Michelle has done remarkable work on the story of addiction from so many angles. And this hour, we want to understand how addiction impacts families. When we've covered heroin and opioid addiction this month, phone calls and emails have poured in, and many of them have been from parents, sisters, brothers, telling stories of how their families were strained or broken and then gradually put back together. When it comes to making progress in the fight against heroin and drug addiction, sometimes it takes a painful personal story to mobilize a community or a government. Families have lobbied, trying to get law enforcement to do more, to get health insurers to cover more, to convince lawmakers to act. We're going to meet some of the people involved in that effort this hour as we look deeper into the impact of heroin and opioid addiction. Let me welcome our guests, and let me start by welcoming my colleague to the studio, helping co-host these 2 hours. Michelle, you've been doing really important work this month, and it's nice to have you back in studio.
Thank you.
Also here is Lori Drescher. She's the mother of a son in recovery and has testified, I think, a couple of times in front of state committees. I appreciate you taking the time to come in today, Lori. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Also here, Lucy Sigari from Rebuilding Shattered Lives. We're going to learn more about what that is. Lucy, welcome.
Thank you.
Also here, Janice Holmes from the Family Recovery Network. Janice, nice to have you.
Thank you.
And Jessica Fowler. And Jessica is with JLF Counseling Services. Jessica, nice to have you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I want to start with Lori Drescher, who is not only the mother of a son in recovery, but someone who has told the story publicly. And not everybody chooses. In fact, most people choose not to be public about it. And as much as you're willing, I'd like to know, you know, more about your own personal story, your family story, and the choices you made as we try to move forward on this issue.
Sure. First of all, I didn't come forward willingly. The first time, my sister pretty much dragged me to the State Senate Task Force last year and said, the story needs to be told. Somebody needs to tell it. And so, and at the time, my son had just gone into his second rehab, and this was after he attempted suicide only by about a week and a half. So, needless to say, I was fairly distraught. But summoned the courage because I realized that there are so many other families who struggle with this, who at this particular point in time have not been able to find their voice. And I believe this disease, and it is a disease, there's no question about it, but this disease lives in the dark. And as long as we keep it in the dark, we're not going to get the real help and resources that we need to be able to provide for families. So my speaking out began that day and continued and has continued since then. And wherever I can and wherever I'm invited, I come to try to create awareness and to reduce the stigma of addiction.
We've heard it all month long. We've heard it, phone calls and emails and parents who said essentially, you know, we never thought it would be our family. But I think reducing the stigma is so important. And I imagine that's difficult but very important work. Your son is how old?
My son just turned 25. And his addiction was an 8-year journey. Much of that time, I was in denial. Many of the signs were there, and I refused to see them. And I can look back now and obviously see many of those signs, but it's very difficult to confront and admit as a parent until, you know, some of the worst signs are very evident, things like stealing, getting arrested, you know, the list goes on. The visible signs aren't nearly as apparent. And at that point, finally had to really confront it. And then I could become an advocate for my son. But I first had to really learn how to take care of myself. And I think that's one of the strongest messages that we're here to share today is how do families first begin to take care of themselves, because we are critically important a support system and partner with our kids and with our family members. But it's counterintuitive to what we know as parents, and so we really have to learn how to be effective.
And we're going to be talking with our various guests about that very important issue. You said it was an 8-year process of addiction for your son. When was the first real confronted conversation? I don't mean confronted in yelling or arguing. I mean the actual conversation about heroin with your son.
Well, there were lots of conversations before that that began with conversations around marijuana. Mm-hmm. And he was evaluated and told that he needed to be in treatment, and we all ignored that advice. The first time we realized that he was taking opiates is when he was arrested and they found a bottle of opiates in his car. It wasn't until he started taking money out of our bank accounts that we actually confronted him, and he sat in my kitchen and rolled up his sleeves and showed me his arms. And I still remember it like it was yesterday, but there was no denying after that. And fortunately, then we were able to act really, really quickly and try to get him into treatment. But that could be another show in and of itself. It was very, very, very difficult to find a place that would be able to take him immediately and then to come up with the resources to be able to pay for it.
Lori, you had told me, and your son had told me, that those signs were difficult to see, especially when he was heavy on opioid painkillers and he was taking those. And he said that was part of the reason he was taking them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
He started taking opioid painkillers when he was in junior high school, when marijuana no longer filled the void that he was apparently feeling in his life. A lot of his friends were popping pills, and they were so available. And I remember him telling me, you know, nobody could detect it because it didn't smell on your breath, your eyes didn't get red. Somebody who really knew what they were looking for would be able to look at the tiny little pupils in your eyes, but that's not a normal detection. So that's how his foray into opiates began. And when those pills began to dry up and became extremely expensive, you know, once the addiction had set in, and it doesn't take long, then he turned to heroin, which is a much cheaper alternative.
And so let me at least say how much I think it's admirable, not only that you share this story in trying to affect change for your son and for others, but also to hear that you were able to come to a point where you can talk to him and he could roll up his sleeves. As painful as that moment is, was he willing to get help at that point? We could do a whole other show, as you say, about trying to find appropriate treatment that's available for in many different ways. Was he willing to get help?
He was willing to get help. He tells me now that he reached a point of utter hopelessness. And that was the point that for him he had to reach in order to be able to accept that his life was no longer manageable in any way. So I think in some ways, some of the things that he did there towards the end before he got into treatment were almost a way of calling attention to his disease. However, he did go into treatment and he was clean for 14 months, but he relapsed. And that's the other thing that we learn as parents is that relapses happen. Nobody likes to accept it. It's a terrible part of a terrible disease, but it's no different than any other disease where you may be in remission for a number of months, and then for whatever reason, there is a trigger, you know, biological, psychological, and the disease comes back. So, but I'm happy to say that at this point, after my son then went into treatment again this last time, that he is now 16 months clean. He's living in a recovery community in Pennsylvania, and he's, for today anyway, doing really, really well.
Do you think it's important that as we accept that relapse is part of the process, that you try to communicate as transparently as possible? Did he communicate with you when the relapse happened?
No.
No?
No, it was, again, it came down to the, you know, a lot of the signs were there. It's so easy to go into denial as a parent, mm-hmm. because you want to believe, especially after 14 months, you want to believe that that they're still clean. But no, the signs, the big signs were back again, the money missing, the jewelry missing, and then it was the attempted suicide. Mm. We made him leave the house when we realized things were missing, and it was when he was out on the street himself for about 4 or 5 days, and how difficult that was, that he again realized he could not continue to live this way. And for him, the thought of suicide was actually more attractive than trying to live without being on these highly addictive opiate drugs.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that it's been a clean 16 months, and everyone is wishing the best for him and for you. I'm curious to know what the most important message you wanted to put in front of lawmakers is. We talk about how sometimes a painful situation for a family can help enact change. Sometimes that means asking insurers why certain things are not treated medically. Sometimes that means asking lawmakers why more is not being done. What message did you share, and are you sharing?
Well, I think for one thing, we have to say that the lawmakers are giving it attention, and laws have been changed. We signed new laws last June.
Yep.
I think the message is that we need a relentless focus, and there needs to be more money in the budget. It is absurd, the small amount of money in the federal and in the state budgets to address this epidemic. So that needs to change. And then we need to continuously focus on getting more and better treatment for the disease of addiction.
Go ahead, Michelle. I know you
so
want to jump
many
in.
Of the reasons that we wanted to have this hour conversation today was because, like you mentioned at the start of the program, how many phone calls did we get from family members that were concerned or who wanted to share their own stories? But a lot of it also had to do with, I spoke with Dr. Richard Blondell, and he's from the University at Buffalo, and he runs a program that trains doctors in addiction medicine fellowship program. And he had something to say about families. He said that families really are integral to any change that is happening.
Who is it right now that has a vested interest in turning this around? Mm-hmm. Usually it's the family members of someone who has died of a drug overdose or someone who has become addicted. They get it. They understand how the system works. They understand why change is needed.
And so, when it comes to the effect on families, Lori mentioned this, and I want to bring our other panelists in on this because, first of all, I guess, Lori, I'll direct the first question to you. As a parent, like you said, you have some denial about what's happening, and then you can't deny it any longer. You have to confront it in a way that offers the right kind of support that hopefully helps someone get clean and rebuild their lives without putting such a strain on, sometimes it's a couple's marriage, sometimes it's other siblings in the family. Can you talk a little bit about that challenge? And then we'll ask other panelists to weigh in as well.
Well, it's a huge challenge. So you've got, you go from a stage of being in denial to confronting whatever the crisis is, because there's usually a crisis. And you've got all kinds of attention being diverted away from the other siblings. So there are issues around that. It can break marriages up. It puts a terrible strain on the family unit. And I think that the message that we just heard is absolutely correct, that this is why families are such an important part of the solution. And yet families are continuously denied from advocating for their kids, from being part of the healthcare solution.
How are they denied?
Well, I don't know if it is still the case, but much of the funding for family participation in therapy was cut from the budget. And any treatment provider will tell you how effective and how important it is to keep the family members involved in the treatment. And yet, that's the low-hanging fruit that gets cut when budget cuts come into place. We also need to have a stronger voice in being able to advocate for our kids. When you are addicted, just like is in any other disease, oftentimes you are not in a position to advocate for yourself. You are very, very sick. And it's a disease of the brain, and so you're not able to cognitively think clearly. And yet we continuously say, until they pick up the phone and make that phone call and arrange those resources for themselves, they're not going to be. So we create barrier after barrier, and we need to remove the barriers and create access to treatment when the addicted brain has a moment of clarity. That's when we need to swoop in with treatment.
Lucy Zagari, Rebuilding Shattered Lives. The term shattered lives, people will think about a person who is addicted to drugs and having their life shattered. But I think it's important to remember that families can feel shattered as well. What does Rebuilding Shattered Lives do?
Rebuilding was created for the family members, actually, not for the person mm-hmm. dealing with the addiction, because it's, like we say, the family is a very important connection to sobriety, I want to say, recovery. It's very, very difficult. A lot of people, like Laurie said, you go into denial. You go through many stages of denial. First, it's, oh, my kid is addicted to drugs. Now what do I do? I'm embarrassed. Then when you realize that the drugs are dangerous, you have no idea what to do at all. You don't know who to call, so you make desperate decisions. You get your kid in rehab, and all of a sudden, you take a deep breath, but you're not fixing the problem that you have gone through at home. You're not changing yourself while your kid is in rehab getting changed. So all of a sudden they come home, the dysfunction is still there, triggers are set, the environment is still the same, and they relapse. And then you're angry again, you start fighting. So it's a vicious cycle. So what I try to do is I try to reconnect the families and give the parents acknowledgement and support. This is what's happening, and it's normal. It's not something, it's not a quick fix to go to rehab. It's not just like that, it's over and done with. They're going to come home and everything's going to be perfect, because that's what a lot of people believe. So we built Rebuilding for that purpose. You lose your identity as an addict. You also lose one as a mom, as a father, as a sibling. We're the left behinds. And we're just sitting there looking at the chaos. The dust settles, and we're just standing alone. So I try to help people build back up from that. This is where you begin, and this is how your family gets healthy. And when you come together as a family unit at this point, it's almost like starting all over again when you first get married and you have your first child. You're learning everything all over again. It's all brand new.
How do they contact Rebuilding Shattered Lives?
Right now, it's word of mouth. We've gone national. It's a Facebook group that I started in October. It's out there. It's, you know, people are just talking. This is what we do. We support each other. I originally started reaching out to parents who have lost children, because that's our biggest epidemic is the parents of kids who have overdosed and passed. I feel that they're just shoved in the background and nobody's paying attention to that sorrow that they're feeling, and how do you get back up from that. But then we started realizing that we all lose. No matter what, we all lose. The minute they that first pill is taken, we lost our kid. Their personality has changed. They're never going to be the same again. And we have to start realizing that we're grieving and going through these processes. Each step is different. We don't know where we are. We don't know who we are. We change. Our friends look at us different. Community looks at us different. So it's an ongoing learning curve for our group, mm-hmm. and we continuously change for what the needs are.
Lori Drescher, have you modified your hope for your son long term? I mean, you hear Lucy saying that, you know, the first pill goes in and someone has changed probably forever. But do you have hope of? I'm curious to know what your hopes are at this point.
My hopes are the same as any other mom for their kids. I probably have a little bit more caution mm-hmm. Around that hope. In many ways, it's brought us closer together as a family. That's the one bright side of going through something as traumatic as this. Together, I no longer say that I only have my son for today, because I believe that my son is in a good place, and I think his recovery is sustainable, and I say that with a lot of hope. I hope that he gets married someday and has a family. He is now living independently, paying all of his own bills, and I never thought in the past that he would be capable of doing that. So I have a lot of hope for my son.
I want to bring in Jessica Fowler, and you can find her work at jlfcounselingservices.com. As a counselor, Jessica, before the hour began, you talked about the fact that when a family goes through this, you can lose time for yourself. You can lose your own identity as a mom, as a dad, as a sibling, just trying to help someone and manage the problems and sort of triage. Can you talk to me about what you have seen in your own practice and what you talk to families about, that importance of trying to find a way to stay strong but also maintain your identity?
Sure. I often talk to families about needing self-care and time to focus and de-stress in crisis, in addiction, that it's very stressful, that affects the body. Sleep is often interrupted, obsessive thoughts, worrying. People may spend time at work texting, looking for their children. Sometimes they put themselves in very dangerous situations trying to find them. So it's very scary. And so learning to manage your stress and take time for yourself, that you don't always have to say yes to everything. You don't always have to give the money. You don't always have to be there to fix it. In learning to just get support and reaching out, I often tell people that I work with that one of my goals is that addiction is not a scary word, that you can say it and not have the fear that that's going to cause them to use, that talking about what's happening is actually very healthy for the family. It's a way to start healing when you address what's happening in the family instead of just, okay, well, they're in treatment, they're good, and we're not going to talk about what happens in treatment. We're not going to talk about how their day was. We're not going to talk about their triggers, their cravings, anything like that, because we're just going to continue on. And actually talking about it is what's going to help heal the family.
I wonder if you've heard this and if this is appropriate. I've heard in families talking about how they dealt with mental illness and taking care of a spouse with mental illness, using the analogy of putting your own mask on, your own oxygen mask on first before going on to helping that other person. Do you think that that's appropriate analogy for this situation?
Oh, absolutely. It's the same idea that you have to take care of yourself. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of somebody else. And when we're stressed like that, we don't think clearly, that, you know, we sort of just want to fix it. We want to solve it. We're just kind of in survival mode, I call it. And so when you're able to get your own basic needs met and find a way to deal with your stress, that you can see things a little bit clearly or look at other options. So maybe you're in a support group and talking about it and hearing about it from other parents or other people who are going through the same thing, that, you know, taking care of yourself allows you to see that that might be an option for you. That might be something you're willing to try, when before, when you were only by yourself or feeling very isolated or alone, you may not have thought about that.
Jessica, the language you use in talking about how it is okay to talk about addiction strikes me as somewhat similar to the language we hear when it comes to suicide, that some families say, well, I don't want to ask about suicidal thoughts because I don't want to trigger something, or I don't think it's okay. I think it's not okay to talk about it. I'm scared to talk about it. Are there parallels there that some people are afraid to talk about certain things?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, just using the analogy of parents that, oh, they had a bad day, I don't want to ask if they're okay or how they're doing because I don't want that to trigger them to think about, are they going to use? If I ask them, you know, if they had a craving today, is that going to then therefore make them have a craving and go use,
right?
And feeling responsible for that when it doesn't work that way, that if they're in treatment, they're talking about cravings, they're talking about triggers, they're talking about their addiction. That's, you don't put that in their head. But understanding and saying, so what I often tell people is that if your child comes to you and says, like, I had a craving today and this is how I dealt with it, or I have a craving, can you come go on a walk with me to help me deal with that until it passes, that's healthy. That's a way to get it out, that they know that they can come and talk to you, and that eventually your thinking is not going to be, okay, they're going to go use. It's going to be, oh, look what my child did.
And again, the point being, if you ask them, did you have a craving today, that's not going to put a craving into their head.
No.
They're not going to turn to you and say, why would you ask me? I've been fine for a while now, and now all of a sudden I do. That's not going to be the scenario.
No, and I'm using that as an example because I don't think that you should go home and ask your child every day if they've had a craving today and if they were triggered. I'm not saying that.
No,
you
but
need
I think
that
dialogue probably is valuable at times.
Yes, and what I think is important is looking at how it affects everyone and just opening the conversation, really, because just as someone has their own triggers when they're either in addiction or they're in recovery, family members have their triggers too that they associate with use. And so if that's not acknowledged, and first identified and then acknowledged and talked about, then it's just this circle of nobody talking about what's happening and nobody talking about how it affects them. And families are affected. Families have a story. They have feelings. And it just needs to be acknowledged and shared.
Let me ask Lori Drescher, the mother of a son in recovery from heroin addiction, when it comes to that conversation, when it comes to being willing to talk about it, what have you observed in your own family?
Well, I've had to learn how to talk about it, and that's why I think it's so important that parents get into some support group, whether it's working with a counselor, whether it's going to Naranon, Al-Anon meetings, and there are some wonderful other support groups in town, Family Recovery Network, Rebuilding Shattered Lives. Really important to know how to have that conversation. For example, I'm thinking about the trigger. If I keep asking my son about triggers and I don't do it in the right way, he's going to then assume that I am once again involved, overly involved in his situation. And, you know, once you're in recovery, it's also really important that the person who's struggling with the addiction is empowered and sees themselves as being in charge of their recovery and of their treatment. You can't want it more than they. You can support, you can go on those walks. But, you know, at the same time, it doesn't need to consume 90% of the conversation, which is really probably coming from your sense of fear versus your sense of wanting to really support.
Well, before I get to a break, and in our second half hour, we're going to bring in Janice Holmes, who's here from the Family Recovery Network, just another resource that's out there. And we're going to find out more about what the Family Recovery Network is. Just one more question for Jessica, if I could. And this is going to sound obvious, but I think we have to put a point on this. When we talk about the impact on a family, the other extreme for a family is we're talking about someone in a family has an addiction. Have you seen marriages strained and fall apart? And then what's the impact on someone dealing with addiction, trying to get clean, when other family members, those relationships are splitting?
It does happen. They need support. It is what I see often is that different views on how to help and what is helping versus maybe something that could be a little more enabling, that they're not on the same page. It's any sort of parenting issue, that there's always a discord that can happen if two parents don't agree on how to handle a situation. And so one of the things that I focus on and will tell parents is that you have to get on the same page and you have to support each other. And so maybe in my office, they'll say, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is the boundary we're going to set. But one isn't able to always do that. And so we talk about what's that plan going to be to support each other so you can help that person follow through with whatever boundary that is that you're trying to set.
Lori, are there questions and debates in families about we have to take a harder line, we have to be firm, we have to show tough love versus we have to help, but are we enabling? Do those conversations happen?
Yeah, that's the biggest conversation that happens in families. And it is not an easy decision to make. I certainly don't go around telling parents, well, it's time to kick your kid out on the street. No parent wants to do that. And there is a way to deal with this through love and through the right kinds of interactions and treatment doesn't necessarily mean, you know, cutting them off from everything. They need your love.
And Lucy Zagari wants to weigh in as well. Lucy?
Yeah, I think that the point that we're missing, too, is that, like you said, when marriages are strained and there's a lot of fighting going on in the house, is that the person who's dealing with the addiction is already in a position where they have a lot of guilt, a lot of self-loathing. So when they see the family falling apart, they put that on their shoulders. They're not going to reach out easily and say, I'm really struggling, I'm really going through this. They actually get further into the addiction, blaming themselves more. So I think it's important at that point, we need to come together, but it's very hard for a family to come together when you have so much chaos. It's time, it's almost like when you're in a boxing ring. There's nobody there ringing that bell and saying everybody back to their corners. You don't know how to do that.
In my reporting for this series, I spoke to several families that they said that it ended a marriage. Several families that mentioned that. The families that did stay together, the parents talked about the strain that it put on their marriage. And then the thing that struck me was siblings and the stress that they were put on, because they said, with the stress, if that they didn't feel the stigma where they couldn't talk about it, people would talk to them, how is your mom doing? You know, how are your parents doing? But not really concerning about what the stress is to be a sibling in that situation. And then parents talking about the guilt that they had about all of the focus on the one child that was addicted and the other child being completely forgotten in many ways.
There are web extras right now. If you go to WXXINews.org, you can find much more of our work on heroin at home. And Michelle, what will they find in terms of what we have on the web right now?
So we have many video extras of different interviews that we did, portions of interviews. We will have at the end of today the full version of an interview with Attorney General Schneiderman about some of the legal changes surrounding heroin in New York State. We have all of the different reports there, so you can see that. You can share it on social media. Hopefully there'll be some links to resources that'll be useful to you as well.
Right, let's get a short break and come back with our panel, and we're going to talk to Janice Holmes in a moment, talking about collaboration instead of isolation. And you understand just how isolated families and family members can feel when addiction happens. That is next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the most impactful and memorable interviews that you might have heard this month in our Heroin at Home series. We recap some of the highlights and have new material for you as well. It's a wide-ranging look at heroin and opioid addiction as we wrap up our month-long coverage, Heroin at Home. Michelle Faust, my colleague, joins me next hour as we run down those stories for you then.
Self-driving cars may be the next big thing, but convincing people to get inside them without taking control is still a struggle. So Google put a big red button in its self-driving car that says stop.
Just like an elevator. Uh-huh. I've never pressed the red button in an elevator, but it's kind of comforting to know it's there.
Letting go of the wheel, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. My guests in studio include my colleague Michelle Faust, who's done such wonderful work on this subject, such important work this month that you can find online in our series Heroin at Home. And next hour, by the way, a lot of what you might have missed, we have a chance to sort of roll back for you. Heroin and opioid addiction from a number of different angles. So that's next hour, along with some more extended interviews as well. But let me introduce the rest of the panel as well. You've been hearing from Lori Drescher, who is the mother of a son in recovery. And as Lori tells us, not only has she testified before government panels, but her own story is right now, we think it's taken a better turn. 16 months clean for her son, and we certainly wish him the best. Lucy Zagari is here from Rebuilding Shattered Lives. Jessica Fowler is here talking about the counseling work that she does. And Janice Holmes is here from the Family Recovery Network. And I want to bring in Janice Holmes to, first of all, just ask, what is the Family Recovery Network?
We are a volunteer community of family members, not just parents, but spouses, grandparents, friends of people who are struggling with addiction, and we bring people together in the true spirit of networking, sharing information, collaborating, and reaching out to community partners to make information and access to services available, not just focused on what you can do to help your loved one, but focused on services that could help the entire family. Also tries to be a conduit for people to get together, where they can go to reach out, to connect with other family members, other people going through the same thing they're going through.
What are the kinds of services that are out there?
This is a tremendous, tremendous community of people who truly care, and I didn't find that out until we started knocking on doors and asking how we can collaborate with them. So everyone from jail workers, RPD, counseling, all the treatment centers, private counselors, school members, school counselors. It's incredible the amount of people who actually are frustrated by this similar problem, who want to be part of the solution, just don't know how to connect. We get people volunteering for us, professionals from U of R and Strong Recovery, to come to our events and provide education absolutely free on their own free time on a Saturday, just because they want to be part of a solution and connect with families and help in this community specifically, people get to a better answer.
A lot of the family members that I've spoken to, it seems like that's their coping mechanism. The way that they're helping themselves heal is by reaching out, whether they have a website that they're talking to other people on or if they belong to a support group, but helping other people from their own experience.
Right. I just want to, picking up on the earlier conversation, say that part of what exacerbates the feelings of isolation and frustration, even when family members are arguing and in disagreement on how to approach the addiction in their family, there is a lack of understanding. There's an assumption that you're going to know. There's an assumption that there is something you can do to talk somebody out of addiction, or if you do look in their backpack and find needles, or if you are finding the problem on their cell phone, yeah, you've been a vigilant parent, you found it, now what? So when I was faced with this problem in my family, when I came out of my denial, I still did not know the so what. What do you do now? There is no clean answer, especially if your loved one is not yet ready for treatment or not yet willing to. And many, many people may never see that. And many people may lose their loved one. And they still deserve recovery. They still need help and support, probably more so than ever in those situations.
I think that's such an important point, because I imagine what constrain couples especially are the questions on, well, what could we have done to find this? As if just finding a needle would have said, well, hey, now we could say, I found a needle, and it'll say, I'm glad you found it, I'll stop. You know, it doesn't, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
What really helped me, because I felt like I was on a personal quest, I went to many, many years of Naranon, and I went to counseling, and I looked, and I asked to school counselors, I asked everyone, and I never got a solid answer. You get everything from just let them hit bottom. You get slogans. You get, sit down, let's have a conversation, as if our family wasn't having conversations. Mm-hmm. So there's an incredible amount of assumption in even the first initial advice you get that says you're going to know what to do just because of the fact that you're a parent and you're sober. So when I turned a corner, it was when I really, truly, for the first time, learned what addiction is. And when Dr. Steven Novak from Strong Recovery came to one of our events, and he described the difference between substance use, substance abuse, and chemical dependency, and how it can appear and people can move in and out of those phases. But when you get to chemical dependency, it's very different. Your brain has changed. It is a disease that you're not going to talk someone out of. The imperative to replace the deficit in their brains with that chemical has changed to become as important as food or water. So when you understand that, you say, everything I've been trying to do really made no sense. I was very uneducated in my approach to what was happening in my family. And then I set out to find and connect and enlighten people with as much education as I could get my hands on. And then I found that we informally, as more moms I met, we started sharing information, we grew in knowledge. And so then we said, let's network this out to and invite others to see how we can grow this.
And so we're talking to Janice Holmes from the Family Recovery Network. How do they contact the Family Recovery Network?
We have a website, www.familyrecoverynet.org, and we're also on Facebook as Family Recovery Network. If you go online and subscribe to our newsletter, then you'll get information about our networking events, and you'll also we send out news and information once a month.
So Janice, let me ask you and Lori a question about the kind of resources that are available. And often there are questions about what's even covered by insurance, what you can get help with. What generally is available and what might be covered by insurance, and does that need to change, Janice?
Well, I think it's not a simple answer. Mm-hmm. And it all depends on the situation in your family, because, as I've said, if your loved one is not willing to get treatment or they're in active addiction, you still need help. So in that situation, I didn't know when I started that as a family member, I could go and get counseling for myself without my loved one. And I can start that process, and I can get the coaching, and I can get support to deal with the stress and turmoil. And I wouldn't even understate it. I had nightmares. I have not been doing well with this, because if you think about what's happening and your loved one has a potential to die at any moment, it's no different than anyone at Vietnam, like watching, you know, potentially someone get blown up in an instance. That's the level of shock and stress that you deal with daily when your person is in active addiction, and you need help with that. You don't know what to do with that naturally by yourself. So you can get help with that.
I mean, how do you go to work and focus on work,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That phone call can ring at any minute, and you don't realize the person working next to you that that's happening in their home because they're so ashamed of it. But if that phone, you're thinking the phone is ringing, it's happened, it's my turn. Your friends are losing their children. You see it happen all around you. Why wouldn't you think it's your turn when that phone rings? And so if you understand that that's what the person's going to next to you, they need help and support probably more than you even realize, even if their loved one is not yet ready for recovery.
Okay, so if someone gets in touch with the Family Recovery Network, you can at least help guide them to these kind of support groups, services are available, and maybe start answering questions on, you know, this is a volunteer service, we can get you help.
Yes.
This, you know, can be covered, this might not. Those kind of questions you can help navigate.
I think in terms of insurance coverage, the best thing to do is to call your health insurance company, because there's all types of complexities with insurance laws and coverage. There's all different types of insurance out there. I would just say that it's complicated, and don't let that deter you from getting help.
Lori Drescher, mother of a son in recovery, what did you find out when it comes to this?
Well, I think I would agree with everything that Janice just said. In addition, and I think, you know, you need to call your insurance company. The other thing is, unfortunately, you need to understand the law, because not all the insurance companies are playing by the rules. And a lot of them are getting away with not playing by the rules because parents are in crisis and they don't know what they don't know. And so if you're told by your insurance company that they're not going to cover something, and let's face it, it is the middle class that has private insurance that is being most discriminated against in terms of being able to get their loved ones into treatment. And so you've got to really educate yourself. You've got to ask the right questions. And if you feel that you've been unfairly denied, you need to call OASIS Legal Department and report it, and then they'll look into it.
Is there an expectation that you might get something favorable if you at least pursue it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But this is just the insurance issue is just one of many issues that creates so much complexity for a family that is already traumatized by learning that their loved one is an addiction. So what I oftentimes will do is I steer, when I get many phone calls from parents, I'll steer them to NCADD Rochester. So it's NCADD-RA.org. And the kind people there have access to know who has, you know, beds available, where to go for a thorough evaluation, whether you need inpatient detox, whether you need inpatient care. So they can help steer you. I also always steer them to Janice's website, familyrecoverynet.org. There is a tremendous amount of resources available just on that website alone.
And for our panel here, is it just a case of insurance not treating addiction like a real medical issue the way they would an injury or otherwise? Does it start there? Or is it simply, because unfortunately what Lori is describing sounds awful. You know, and it sounds like families are vulnerable, families are hurting, people have needs, and yet that vulnerability is used against you. So
if you,
how is it
if you had a child that had cancer and you took them to the doctor, you would not be denied treatment. we face a very different situation. And Janice really hit the nail on the head when she said, you know, until you really understand the nature of the disease of addiction, you have a tremendous amount of judgment. Our physicians, on average, receive about 3 hours of training on addiction in their medical education. And so we need our medical professionals to understand the nature of the disease of addiction, and we need to stop prescribing opiates for pain.
So just to make a reference, in our next hour, we will be talking about this, some of the movement towards getting more treatment or getting more training for doctors in addiction and understanding that just for every doctor, and then doctors who are specializing in it. But we'll also be talking about the idea of mental health parity and the laws that do require insurers to cover addiction as they would any other disease.
And before I grab a phone call, I know that Lucy Zagari wanted to weigh in as well on that. Go ahead, Lucy.
Yeah, my addiction with my son started fast and furious. His was a short term. It wasn't a long 8 years or whatever. It was 18, he started with a sports injury, but I think the extremes that he went through, I have gone through all of the stages, the denial. You don't know what to do, so you go to you call your pediatrician or your family doctor. They tell you call the police. They don't. There isn't a person that you can call, and they're going to say you need to do this, you need to do that. That's what we're lacking. We're lacking a support system. Each stage, as Janice was pointing out before, is like you're at a point. I don't think that a child is going to be ready to come to you and say that I'm having the craving, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. You all start fighting and everything like that. But I'm sorry, I'm getting dizzy.
It's okay. It's all right, Lucy. I'm going to grab a phone call. This is Bud in Chilai. Go ahead, Bud.
Yes. I don't know if your guests are aware of a company, Arena Pharmaceuticals in San Diego, but they have a drug starting clinical trials, ADP 371, which it replaces opioids for pain management, and it could very well supply an addict with the sensation he wants, but without the addictive qualities. I would recommend they contact Arena and find out more about it. ADP 371.
Bud, thank you. I don't know much about it. Lori, nothing? No, I haven't heard. Janice, have you heard anything on that scale? At the very least, we're talking about the question of replacing opioids in general. And Lori Drescher, you said, got to do it.
Well, when you figure that the United States consumes 95% of the world's hydrocodone and 80% of the world's oxycodone.
Wow.
And we are 5% of the world's population. We have a problem here in the United States, period, with over-treating pain. And I'm not saying that there are not legitimate reasons for using these strong narcotics for pain, but generally speaking, a doctor would tell you it's for end-of-life care and for acute treatment after surgery. But we are way, way over-prescribing. Mm.
So one thing I wanted to, you know, kind of chime in on is this is the exact need for collaboration. So when you hear of possible treatments and when you hear about insurance issues and when you hear about things, independently we may think they'll work, but together we can make them work and we can bring this into the community and we can reach out to our partners at Strong Recovery, who also do maintenance programs drug-assisted treatment. So let's ask them for help, and I think that's the way we move forward instead of vilifying any one, issue or problem or entity. We work together within the fabric to make it work and make it real.
It is familyrecoverynet.org. Online for the Family Recovery Network. Jessica Fowler's services can be found at jlfcounselingservices.com. Rebuilding Shattered Lives has a Facebook page, a growing group there. And Lori Drescher, I got about 30 seconds left here. What would you want to see? What's the next change that you want to see that could make an impact on this issue to help families, to help people in addiction?
Well, I think it's probably the discussion that you're having next, which is how do we start to dry up some of the opiates that are on the street. But the bottom line for families is you do need support, and there are support networks out there. Do not think that you have to be alone in this. You can draw great strength from other families, and you can learn a tremendous amount from other families who are going through this.
We've learned that all month long through Michelle's reporting and through meeting people like all of you. Lori Drescher, best of luck to you and your family, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Lucy Zagari from Rebuilding Shattered Lives. Thank you, Lucy. Nice talking to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Janice Holmes, Family Recovery Network. Janice, nice to meet you here, and thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Fowler. Thank you, Jessica, for taking the time as well.
Thank you.
All right, short break. And if you missed any of our coverage all month long, we have some of the highlights of those interviews that you won't want to miss next hour.